Welcome to the Rerooted Podcast with Francesca Maxime, trauma-sensitive mindfulness meditation teacher and poet. Together, we'll take a closer look at approaches to transforming trauma with insights from psychology, neuroscience, spirituality, social justice, and the creative arts. Join Francesca and her guests for an exploration of our shared connection and how we can cultivate greater compassion for ourselves and for others. If you'd like to support Francesca and the Rerooted Podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Francesca.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Rerooted Podcast. I'm Francesca Maxime, and I am so happy to be joining you today in conversation with an interview that I taped recently with Dr. Michael Yellowbird. You will remember Dr. Yellowbird as a dean of social work at the University of Manitoba, who is able to speak from a collective and Indigenous perspective and embodied experience around what it is that are some of the considerations that we are leaning into and looking at as we begin to look at the imbalances that we may have found ourselves in life that lead us to an environmental crisis, into an interpersonal crisis, and perhaps into a spiritual crisis. So this interview was conducted by me and Dr. Yellowbird with and for the International Study for the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. And it was done over the summer of 2020 in the middle of the uprising and the pandemic. And I'd like to share this with you now here for you listeners on Rerooted.
Hey everybody, I'm Francesca Maxime having this conversation with Dr. Michael Yellowbird around really talking and digging into the ways in which Indigenous folks across the globe, really, I think, Michael, have had a certain set of experiences that is not often acknowledged or dealt with or processed with the larger collective, and that shows up in a variety of ways. And also, what can we do now and what's appropriate. So this is for that International Trauma Association that I was talking about. And I guess if you want to give a little bit of background as to who you are and what you are doing or about in terms of your professional work, and also maybe some of your personal background there, that might be a nice way for people to just that are set up and locate you, so I can put this in context for the article. I know what it is, obviously, because I know you, sure. But just for the purposes of this.
Okay. Well, good morning. My name is Michael Yellowbird. I am Dean and Professor of the Faculty of Social Work at the University of Manitoba in Canada. My background is in social work. I've done a lot of work in social work and more specifically in health around Indigenous people. So I've spent a lot of time examining health and well-being among Indigenous people, particularly through the lenses of colonization and decolonization. So I've made most of my academic career on looking at those particular paradigms and frames, and how to use them as analytical sort of measures to kind of determine, you know, how Indigenous people have fared in the evolution ever since they've had contact with outsiders, throughout the world. So that's kind of really what I've been doing a lot of my research. I'm actually Arikara and Hidatsa, two tribal groups from what is now North Dakota, from the Fort Berthold Reservation. I grew up there for a good part of my life when I was young, and then I traveled quite a bit at different universities. And I come from a family of 15 in a community that's very much a collectivist community. So our people were hunter-gatherers / traditional horticulturalists who were part of this really huge trade network prior to European colonization in the United States. So it's interesting because a lot of people don't know this, that we had these amazing trade routes in different parts of Turtle Island, North America, actually extending all the way down to South America. So if people examine that today, they'll see that, you know, at one time there were hunter-gatherer groups, horticultural groups, confederacies, empires, no pastoral people that we know of, but all kinds of dynamic groups that moved across Turtle Island, trading goods, intermarrying, exchanging DNA, changing, exchanging ideas, spirituality, and marking all of Turtle Island with really a lot of symbols, petroglyphs, rock carvings, symbols in the ground, like great big medicine wheels or in rocks, those kinds of things. So I'm really interested in that kind of work too, as well, to kind of see how we interacted and how we involved ourselves with one another across time. And time's getting more and more extensive. If you look at the archaeological record here of how long people have been here, Indigenous people say, well, we've been here since time immemorial. We don't know how long we've been here, but always have been here. But what's really interesting is that as we look further and further on the time, you know, we get to understand that there were many innovations and things that people did while they were here that hadn't been shown up in Europe or in Asia or any other places. So, or some things that did simultaneously happen here in this part of the world. So I'm part of those kinds of groups that, you know, I have got the genetic background that sort of is incorporated to all these different groups. So I'm very interested in that and very interested in what's happened to Indigenous people at the beginning of the time that, you know, there is some kind of recorded history and then archaeological history. And then, of course, what happened to Indigenous people after contact with Europeans. So those are areas I'm very interested in.
Right. Yeah, no, thank you so much. After contact, putting it mildly. So I guess where we are now, it's the summer of 2020. We're in the middle of the pandemic still, and we're in the middle of what is, a protest movement, a Black Lives Matter, you know, protest movement, particularly here in the United States, but also I think a call to, you know, sort of interrogation around these systems, these colonialist systems and their legacies of whiteness or white body supremacy or whatever term you want to use around that oppressive systemic nature of extraction and not regeneration and that sort of more balanced way of being that we know is intuitive to what you described, to just the Indigenous cultures that you just described. So at this time, when issues of racial violence and discrimination are being actively debated in our mainstream media, how does one effectively work with Indigenous peoples? Whether it's, there's probably not just one answer, but how at this time does one consider being more effective in working with Indigenous people? At this time, is there anything specific or different because of the pandemic, or are there things that are just continuing that we need to do differently?
Well, I think, you know, it's kind of both. I think there are things that people can specifically do to begin to understand who Indigenous people are. I think that's it depends really where you are in the world, though, first of all. The United States is one of those, you know, that has a very low Indigenous, you know, quotient. I mean, they just don't understand Indigenous people down in the United States. It's a country that has all kinds of different political, you know, sways from here and there. But that's the more difficult thing is that the U.S. really has not had its own reckoning. It really hasn't had, you know, a very, very in-depth look at its history. I mean, you're dealing with a settler colonial history that, you know, is based upon genocide and rape and torture and dispossession and theft, you know, of, you know, billions of acres of land and riverways and those kinds of things. So I think that's the first thing Americans really need to do. In Canada, that's happened. It's still happening in Canada. It's happening in Australia, New Zealand. It's happening in different parts of the world with Indigenous people. In Norway and Finland, those kinds of conversations have been going on. The U.S. somehow, you know, just doesn't look beyond its own borders. So yeah. It doesn't see that going on. The U.S., like Canada, like New Zealand and Australia were the last four countries to sign on to UNDRIP, which was the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they had committed so many crimes against Indigenous people, crimes of humanity, by taking kids away, you know, by stealing land, by appropriating, you know, all these things from Indigenous people. And basically that's what settler colonialism is all about. It's about wiping them out and taking, you know, it's like the elimination of the native is what it's really about. So it hasn't really had its reckoning, you know. People, there really hasn't been like truth and reconciliation commissions in the United States with Indigenous people. that's kind of happening now, I think, with Black Lives Matter. I'm not sure if there is enough truth and reconciliation there yet. It's just kind of a baby movement right now, as I see it, mm-hmm. which is really good. I think it's really, it's breaking out, and it's forcing people to begin to examine, you know, all these Confederate generals, all these symbols and all these markers of white supremacy is really what it's doing. And it's very uncomfortable, I think, for people. It's very uncomfortable. I mean, it's like people are more comfortable with anti-racism than they are examining their own white supremacy. That's pretty clear.
Can you elaborate on that? People are more comfortable with anti-racism work than they are with examining their own white supremacy. I find that fascinating and true, and I know what you mean, but yeah. I would like you to elaborate.
Yeah, so anti-racism is like, you know, we can speak out against it, and that's wrong, you know. That's not about me, it's about someone over there from, you know, who has a Confederate flag or whatever. It's that's how we see racism. It's like, you know, we don't see our own position as being racist. We don't see our own, you know, a privilege in society as being white supremacy or white nationalism, right? And you know, it's all the whites, right? All the white stuff, right? So if you got the privilege, you know, I got white privilege, so I can go out and I can stand on a protest line against racism, right? But I'm not going to do a damn thing about, you know, helping improve the lives of people in the inner city change, you know, the structure to eliminate structural or systemic racism, right? I'm not going to rebel against any things like that. I'm going to do things that are easy because I've got that privilege. And I think that's what it is. It's the anti-racism is like, well, I mean, I can talk about it. I can even, you know, say I'm against it. I can wear a t-shirt, you know, and I can do all these things. But, I'm not going to examine myself, how I'm part of the system, mm-hmm. how I perpetuate the system, you know, by paying taxes to the police, you know, that go out there and destroy these communities, you know, and murder these people, right? I think that's different. It's very different, you know, because white supremacy, white nationalism, you know, we can't get to that because of, you know, something called white fragility, right? It's like people are so fragile about, you know, their place and about anything that challenges their privilege, right? That's the idea. It's like, I mean, that's why right now it's easier. I mean, it's difficult, but it's easier now to bring down Confederate generals, you know, to bring those down because of, you know, what they did. I mean, they fought this war to maintain slavery. So people are doing that, but it's much more difficult, I think, for those of us to go out there and to demand change in the curriculum. Say, I'm not sending my kids to school until you change that damn curriculum.
Right.
I'm not going to do that. See, that in itself is
change
white privilege.
Meaning it's more accurate to actually reflect the history of this country in terms of enslavement and genocide.
Right, exactly. And to teach kids the truth, right? I'm not going to do that, right? That's my privilege. Right? But I can go out there and say, well, I want people to have higher wages. I want them not to be beaten by the police. But systemically, I'm not going to do a damn thing. Right? I'm going to send my kids to school. I'm not going to, I'm going to continue on, you know, with all these different kinds of, you know, things that are part of the system. So I think that's the difference, is that people are easily kind of say, I can be anti-racist, but I cannot look at my own white supremacy. Right? Mm-hmm. That's too threatening. I don't want to look at it, right? So.
Yeah, and so I appreciate that. It's the self-interrogation. I just say interrogating whiteness. That's sort of the way, shorthand that I've used to describe it. And interrogating whiteness and the way in which it shows up in me as a person is what I need to be looking at if I am a white-bodied or a light-skinned privileged passing person that has inherited a certain degree of privilege that's not afforded to others. Given all of what you say, in terms of the personal piece, how then does one effectively work with indigenous communities, as you said, all across the world? There are other countries doing different things. I'm in the United States, you're in Canada, we are on Turtle Island, North America. However, there are other communities across the world that are and have done a better job in terms of reconciling or reckoning, although there's still work to be done and is being done. How does one work clinically, perhaps, with indigenous people during this time in a way that's effective psychotherapeutically? Or do we not use Western techniques as we know them, if you will? And is there a better way that is perhaps more collectivist based?
You know, I that's a good question. Thanks for the question, because I really have been, I mean, I've trained a lot of clinical social workers. I've trained a lot of social workers my day. I'm not a clinical social worker, but you know, you kind of get them through the process and then they get their clinical training. But for me, I'm really glad you raised that, because I think clinical work, you know, I think is important work. Don't get me wrong. I think it has its place. But as we look at Indigenous people around the world, we have come to understand, you know, through a lot of cultural neuroscience, that these are collectivist cultures. Culture evolves with our genetics, right? Our genetic profiles. So that we have particular genetic variants that help us maintain our sense of equilibrium and well-being, right? But it has to be in a cultural context. What I mean by that is that, you know, some people are going to do so much better in a community therapy or big group therapy, right? If you're going to have any kind of therapy, they're going to do much better. And they're going to, and for Indigenous people, that looks to me to kind of be what's happening now, is that we're kind of moving in that, slowly moving in that direction, to understand how important it is for people to be in the company of others in order to heal. Talking about, you know, what's wrong, I think is kind of, it's really a colonized kind of a way to do that. I mean, we can talk about that for a while, but you have to get back to the strength of the society. What are the protective factors in the society that make people stronger and make them resilient, right? So in times like this, I think therapeutic approaches are ones that I've seen, like three case studies that I've seen around the world. One in Australia, I can't recall the particular all the particulars of it, but this one Aboriginal woman who had almost single-handedly brought down suicide on her own by going back to what she called the care factor. Hmm. Right? She doesn't have a degree. She's not a clinical psychologist. No Western training, but essentially what she did, you know, and you can find this, which I had in front of me. What she did is that she got sick and tired of seeing people in her community die. They had like the highest rates of suicide in the world. And then you can find this on the web, right? Mm-hmm. So she started spending time with people when people were really, you know, at that point of ideation. She would go spend time with them, sit with them, and just be with them, you know, for hours, or stay overnight with them and just sit there while they fell asleep or whatever she did. Mm. And that was the care factor. And then as other older women in the village started seeing that, that's what they started to do. So pretty soon they were all going out and they were like patrolling. And when they would say someone's feeling really bad or down, they would go, they would sit with them. So it wasn't just a 5-minute talk or an hour talk, time's up kind of thing. They would spend the whole day with the person, you know, maybe washing dishes, sweeping floors, sitting with them, telling them stories while they fell asleep. All those things, you know. And
even as you're saying that, I'm getting choked up because it's just so powerful what you're saying, you know. It's just that it's so real, like a human needs care and to feel not alone and to feel like someone is actually pausing and noticing and meeting you in that space is really powerful.
Yeah. And I think that's what people were picking up on, right? They're picking up on
this
genuine idea that someone cares about me.
Yeah.
Time with me.
God forbid. It's not just a job. They actually care.
Yeah. And so that was one case study that, and this woman goes around and talks about that now, like, right, it's like, you don't need all these degrees. You don't need advanced training to do that. You basically go back to, you know, the tradition of that particular cultural group, which is to like, this is what we do. You know, we network with each other. We care for one another.
That we belong to one another.
Yeah. Yeah. That in itself is a very collectivist approach to life. It's not an individualistic approach to life. And I would dare say that if you went in there, you took a swab of those folks, you'd find out that they had, you know, a genetic variant, you know, that was what it was called, a serotonin transporter gene, right? STG, that, you know, serotonin, you know, would rise and dopamine levels rise when you have that kind of close contact, when people care about you, right? And it reinforces that. So all you have to do then after a while is see these people in the community, you see the smile, you feel their energy, you see that they're doing their work, and then it sort of blends into your own activity, right? And after a while, you get so good at it that you all, you know, and there's another part of the brain that activates. It's the insula, right? Which is the part of the brain that really is looking at what we call social and emotional intelligence. You begin to see the social needs that people have and where they are mentally just by looking at a person.
Yeah.
Right? And you get used to that after thousands and thousands and thousands of years, so that even before, you know, someone even begins to tip the other way, you're there.
Yeah.
To balance them, right?
Yeah.
Kind of the plate that's tipping, you're balancing them before right. It even starts to go off the rocker or slide off.
Right.
That's how cultures survive.
Yeah, beautiful. Right?
That's how cultures survive. So that was in Australia. There's another one that was in Alkali Lake in British Columbia. Very similar. Again, another indigenous group. They didn't have people do clinical work and sit down, you know, with folks. And what happened was that there was a lot of alcohol in this community, a lot of alcohol, even down to the little kids who were drinking, you know, bottles of alcohol when parents got drunk and they had nothing to eat, so they would drink alcohol at the table.
Mm.
Parents, you know, one family got, you know, it all started when a little girl didn't want to stay with her mother anymore. She wanted to stay with her grandmother. The mother was upset, and she told the father, I'm going to stop drinking and you got to stop drinking. So they did. And then they start going out to the community. And when they went out to the community, that's exactly what they did. They used this very collectivist community approach. They didn't sit down and say, you know, tell me about your historical trauma. Tell me about, you know, why you, you know, how you feel that you don't have a job. What they did is they start saying, you know, we all have to get out of this, you know, mess together. And so what they started to do is they started to kind of clean out, you know, some of the problems. One was a priest that was an alcoholic, you know, in the community. They chased him out. They got rid of him.
Yeah.
Another were bootleggers coming into the community. They stopped that. Yeah. And pretty soon they all began working together, you know, as a collective. They started caring. It's a care factor again.
Right.
They all were caring about each other. And then they took the next level where they started to going back to indigenous ceremony.
Mm.
And that's the healing, that, you know, sweat lodges and pipe ceremonies and all the ceremonies that they had lost during the period of colonization.
Right.
They began to go back to these things that, you know, were right for them, that were part of who they were, that, you know, even the smell of tobacco or sage has a genetic olfactory response in the brain.
Right.
You know, as soon as you smell that, you know, it sets, you know, into motion something that's sacred and healing in the body. Well, how is that? Well, it's, you know, people have done that for generations and generations and generations and generations. So it's not like blood memory or anything like that, like people talk about. What it really is really there's a genetic system and an olfactory system set up to understand, you know, that's a dangerous smell. That's a friendly smell.
Right.
A helpful smell. That's a spiritual smell, whatever it is. We have that, you know, capacity. And because indigenous people there in that part of the world have been doing it for such a long period of time, making music, whatever those kinds of things are, then, you know, it's easy. It was easy for them to transition back into that space where then they begin to, hit their set point again. Yeah, reclaim, reset their genetics, their genetic epigenetic expression, and I think once they were able to do that, you know, they the community healed, and that's an excellent case study.
Beautiful.
So there are more of these that have happened. I have never seen one. And I'm not saying there isn't one, but I've never seen one where you have individual, you know, Western clinical healing that's healed a whole community.
Mm.
It may heal a few people, right? But you take those people and you put them back into that same place where there's a lot of sickness and disease, you know, their chances of maintaining their homeostasis and their well-being are going to be greatly diminished.
Yeah.
This is why for indigenous people, you know, collectivist healing, that kind of thing, especially during times like this with COVID, is so important. But also, you know, it's also a danger too, because you can't get into that close proximity, you know, with one another, you know, because of the spread of COVID. So it's difficult. So it may be even harder on people more than that, because a lot of people want to get together. They want to feast together. They want to dance together. They want to sing together. All these things that collectively they do, right? That were outlawed by colonization. And now they've sort of gotten back. And now they kind of have to be very careful about doing that to watch the spread of COVID. So,
balancing that healing property and that, you know, that the reclamation of the, you know, mutual celebration can bring, and, you know, the co-regulation with the nervous system and the group and all of these things that we know neuroscientifically and with, you know, our vagal, you know, systems and all of that, along with what's actually prudent in a time of COVID and how to do that. I know one of the things that I've offered to people over the last few months has been a Zoom dance party where I sort of play DJ and we all from, you know, a group of people that we know from college get together, and 50 of us or something will, you know, dance together in our chairs or whatever it is as we play these music, you know, music from our time, from, you know, when we were in college. And that it has been something that's been healing in a different kind of a way than, for example, the racial affinity group and book group that they have going on with some of my classmates or things like that. That those are good for left brain didactic understanding and information and knowledge to sort of, you know, have that. But that also this sense of like, okay, well, we're not so isolated and alone, even though we feel that way. It's been a way of trying to create some of this that you're talking about in the way that I could not. I mean, I can't do these other pieces, right? But that's healing. That has nothing to do with me being a psychotherapist. That has me to do with caring about my colleagues from college and wanting to just offer that and enjoy that with them and be in it and enjoy and receive as well as the doing, right?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things, you know, that when we're talking about healing, I think that, you know, some of the work that I've done and I've looked at a lot of the research, and I found, and it's no surprise to me why humans like to dance, right? I mean, really, and that all humans have kind of formed different kinds of dance or dance societies and different kinds of dances and so on, and for different reasons have danced, even during the plague, right? The plague in the Black Plague that happened in Europe. That's where the Ring Around the Rosie comes from, that kind of dance, right? Mm-hmm. Where people were dancing around, you know. But, you know, people have always done that, you know, when they're trying to divine, you know, the future or divine what's going to happen next. Singing and dancing are expressions, right? And it's sometimes, you know, whatever it helps them with. But we know now some of the neuroscience behind that. We know that, you know, when people dance and they sing, they have this dramatic rise, especially something very meaningful, a very meaningful dance, sacred dance or whatever it is, this dramatic rise in endocannabinoids in the brain. And of course, what that does is, you know, blunts pain, increases the feelings of well-being, you know, raises the brain drive, neurotrophic factor in the brain. So you're actually sort of, you know, protecting your brain by, you know, generating more neurons and so on. So these things are, you know, that are very ancient.
Yes.
They're so healing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the first thing that kind of went by the wayside when colonialism came, right? It was just the production. It was just work. It was just seriousness. It was a fearful God. You know, it was like a fun play. Those kinds of things all went out all were ushered out. In terms of, you know, progress and production, which caused, you know, this huge, I think, dramatic change in people's well-being, the rise of depression, anxiety. Those are all novel diseases, by the way, for human beings. Mm. We did not have those. Our ancestors, hunter-gatherer ancestors, even our horticultural traditional ancestors, all of us did not have those levels of depression that we have today. And that's pretty clear that, you know, this is something that's novel with us. And we're seeing it, you know, even more accentuated with this COVID-19 that's happening right now. It's like, you know, we're seeing that. People are so, I think, anxiety-ridden that they just want to break out of this and send their kids to school and go back to work. So they want to sacrifice, you know, themselves, you know, or their kids or their grandparents or whoever. They just don't know. And that's how anxiety ridden I think people are. People say they're anxious. And I'm saying, I think it's anxiety, deep anxiety. That's going to turn into depression here soon. Yeah. Really high levels. Yeah. Right. And that's why we're seeing, I think, you know, especially in the United States, all this behavior that's just, you know, outrageous behavior where people are taking off their masks and coughing at other people, or they're, you know, pulling out guns on each other, and they're trying to, you know, they're sending people, they're letting people go into these stores or beaches where they're unprotected, and with the, you know, there's just such resistance to it. But I think that's what's happening. It's more of a psychological, you know, sort of a just mass psychological condition and happening to people, you know, in the States. Every place else too, as well, but you know.
Right, but that there's a different way. This sort of rugged individualism philosophy here is forcing it to play out a little differently. Thank you for that. That's really powerful. Just a couple more questions. We have about 20 minutes left. Maybe this is something to sort of tail off of what you were saying earlier. How does trauma and dissociation show up among an Indigenous group that white clinicians may not know how to treat? And what should they do differently? I think we kind of answered that, but just sort of, is there anything else there about that?
I think, you know, I mean, I think it's really important maybe just to go back to the clinician, not think so much about the person, you know, but to think about, you know, what clinicians need more of, what they need to learn more about, invest more time in neuroscience, invest more time in understanding cultural neuroscience and epigenetics. And then look at things that Indigenous people do, their own cultures did that they've perhaps forgotten about, you know, how important language is, how important it is to be, you know, with, you know, your tribe or your people. People talk about that all the time, my tribe, right? Mm. But it really is, you know, with Indigenous people, it's not like a made-up tribe. It is a real tribe that's based upon different kinds of social, you know, orders and relationships and that kind of thing, that people have certain obligations to each other, right? It's not something you make up, you know. And the other thing about it is that, you know, why are these things that, you know, that we've done in Western healing, you know, why haven't they been successful, I think, with particular groups of people? And again, it's the understanding and the idea that we did talk about, I think, is collectivism. I really, really think that we just don't have a very, very strong understanding or clue about what collectivism is and how important it is in the lives of some people, you know, and what it does to people's health when they're denied humor.
Yeah,
when they're denied the ability to dance, the ability to, you know, to smile, the ability, you know, all these things have very, very difficult, you know, are very difficult for people. The other thing I think, you know, therapists, you know, could learn, just last thing, is that, you know, there really needs to be a change when you're working with Indigenous people. There are things that Indigenous people, many Indigenous people are people not only in collectivist culture, but they have a genetic variant I talked about before, this 5-HTTLPR gene, which is a variant that codes for humor. You know, it's kind of the funny bone, kind of called the funny bone gene.
Yeah.
And they're already primed for that. So when, you know, it's like bringing them in and talking only about historical trauma and about the pain and racism, you know, that's important. But, you know, one should never, ever leave someone at that level. There should always be a lot of laughter and humor and the ability to laugh at that situation that's happened so you can, you know, conquer it or count, as we say, count coup on that situation, right? Mm-hmm. Have some control over it. I laugh at the oppression. I laugh at the racism, you know.
I have agency now, right? Like, I'm here.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. So I think therapists really have to understand that, you know, it's like, you know, it's not that racism can beat us, but it's that, you know, there's a lot of actors and factors that are involved that are doing it. And a lot of that are factors and actors that are standing by letting it happen too as well.
Yeah. 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 A certain level, like, you know, I take my agency back. I take my power back. I can see it from a distance enough to engage in it, to say, yes, this happened. And how am I relating to what happened? And is there an opportunity to use that funny bone humor piece as a way to create enough space and relaxation around it in such That's a way right. that, you know, I don't have to be all jacked up and contracted around it, right?
That's right.
That it doesn't deny the reality of what happened. It doesn't just fixate on it, however.
Yeah, I
appreciate that so much. Perhaps this next question is from your own experience. And again, like you say, you're not exactly a clinician, but clearly working with people on all different levels over time. Please share some therapy experiences that are healing or have been healing for Indigenous folks and how they may differ from how white clinicians might treat white clients. I think that's sort of saying this question in yet a different way. And maybe you already did sort of explain them in the ways in which you talked about the two case studies with the care, the caring, and the way in which the embodiment is the way that I use it. I talk a lot about embodiment as a somatic psychotherapist and the way in which that keys into the things you were talking about neuroscientifically and also with our limbic system and the insula and things like that around how we are with interrogating our own whiteness, being able to hold both the reality of our own lived limbic experience and our imprinting around our own internal colonization. And the more that we're able to be with that, the more we can show up in an embodied way that allows us to be more available in ways that can see and invite in a caring heart, a caring, I don't know what you said, what was it? A care case?
The care factor.
The care factor. Right. Yeah. And that's an embodiment that emanates from the bottom up from me and isn't a performative way of my doing therapy or being with others. I always have said, for example, for me, that you had mentioned in the last question response, people have certain obligations to one another in this collectivist response, in this collectivist community. And I remember in high school, one of the speeches I wrote was about community and what is community. And at the time, I was probably 16 or 17, it was that it was need-based and that it was dependent on one another. The health of the community was essentially like not a tit-for-tat transactional to the T, but whatever it is that I'm offering is something that's needed by someone else, which is the glue that is then being offered to someone else that they can receive and that it's interdependent. And so that it's necessarily need-based and bound in that way. Like you say, you know, people have certain obligations to one another and ethically and morally, they come forward to do that. Yeah. So I'm kind of riffing off here on my own experience, but I'd like to maybe just come back and say, are there any therapeutic experiences that are healing or have been healing for Indigenous folks and how may they differ from white clinicians might treat white clients? What does a white clinician do with a white client that they wouldn't want to be doing with an Indigenous client? Maybe that's a better way to say it.
Yeah. Well, I can share. I just finished a book with a colleague. It should be out in October. And in this particular book, we talk about decolonizing pathways to integrative health is the title of the book. We do some storytelling in there. We're talking a lot about, you know, the literature and talking about helping and social work and that sort of thing. But we do some storytelling in there. And one of the stories that I told was something that, you know, I still hold dear to me, was that years ago, my oldest son, my second oldest son, he had a horse riding accident. We were out, you know, and he was thrown from a horse. Mm. And he was okay. You know, he was hurt, but he was okay. And I told my father about it. It was in the summertime. We had traveled home. I was doing my PhD at the time, traveled home. We spent time with my parents. We had horses there, thrown from a horse. And then, so then my father listened to what I told what happened. And then he said, well, you better go see this guy who does the ceremony when someone gets thrown from a horse. He knows, he'll know what to do. And I had never heard about that. So then I called that guy, this elder, that night. And this guy he's a very, very prominent healer and medicine person, Sundance chief, you know, on our reservation, you know. So I called him and he said, come over. So I went over the next morning. When my son and I were driving along and my son says, well, what's he going to do? And I said, I have no idea. Not sure what he's going to do. So we got there and we did the normal things we do. My son, you know, that was his grandfather, you know, through his mother. So he put together, you know, some things for his grandfather, you know, a package of gifts, which is what we do, right? To get the teaching or whatever it is. You know, we don't give them money, but we give them...
Meaning that in a collectivist society such as this, this medicine man that you didn't know was considered a grandfather as an elder. And in order to be able to come and receive the teaching, and one offers gifts. Is that...
Yeah, like, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
You're considered family. You're not other.
Right. Well, see, I knew him, but he wasn't related to me. He was related to my son. But my son didn't know him very well at the time.
I understand. Okay.
Yeah. So we got there. So we get there So I tell him he's coming. So we drive early in the morning. We get there. We get to his place. So it's out near the Badlands, right? So it's a beautiful area. You know, there's on the Great Plains there. So we drive up, and he's standing in a circle with all kinds of sage, a sacred circle he's already put, and he's praying to the north, right? So we stop, and we wait there like this, just wait for him to get done praying. But he turns around, he calls us in, we go, and we get into the circle, and then he you know, lets us in, and then he cleanses us off. So then he says all these long prayers, and so then we stood there, right, with him, because he was saying in his language, a Mandan language. So once he finished, then we went out to his house, we talked about what had happened, and then he brought my son back out into the circle, and we told him, you know, he had been thrown from a horse. So then he brushed him off, and he did all this healing ceremony, he said all these prayers, and he turned him to all the sacred directions and did all these things, right? So it's a long time, right? This is therapy, right?
Yeah.
And then I thought we were done. So my son was going to give him the gifts and stuff. And he says, now we have to go, and we have to go heal the horse. You know,
I said,
the horse has had trauma. So I said, okay, I didn't expect that. So we had to drive all the way around the reservation again and got there. We got to the horse, and then he did the ceremony around the horse. You know, I got the horse, and then the horse was, you know, I explained, you know, in the story what happened. And then after he did that, I thought we were done. He says, now we need to go and heal the ground this happened on. So, okay. So he went to the area, and he got to the area, and then he started to heal the earth, the trees, all the birds, the grass. Talk to all these things, he said, because he said there was a trauma that happened. He said, you always do this thing, you know, because you've got the sacred animal, you've got the sacred child, you've got the sacred place, everything's sacred. He said, we have to always, when we remember, return things back to balance, right? That's my responsibility as a healer. So we waited there, and he did that, and he's talking to the birds and all those kinds of things that witnessed that. He said, you know, and then he used the word trauma. He said, you know, we have to help them, you know, get over the trauma they experience. He said, the ground experiences, you know. He said, it's alive. He said, these things are alive. So we did that. We finished up, and then we got into my truck, and we started driving. I started driving him home. It was kind of in the evening. Sun was starting to set in the west, and he asked me if I, my dad told me about the ceremony. I said, no, he just told me to see you. And I said, okay. And then that was it. That was it. We drove into the night, right?
Mm.
But that in itself, you know, it talks about restoration in trauma, right? It's not just the individual.
Yeah.
It's all these things that have been involved, right? So you have to, because in his mind, everything is alive. Everything is, you know.
Yeah, animate.
The sentience to it, right?
Mm.
So to me, that, you know, that's clinical to me, right? The clinic is the world, man. It's not an office, man. It's everything. And I think most indigenous people will tell you that. And if they do have a sweat lodge clinical ceremony, I mean, even the sweat lodge is representative of the whole world. It's not like my office.
Right.
And it's got, you know, it's got all the sacred directions and all these live, you know, rocks that are the grandfathers, and you've got all this ceremonial stuff happening, you know, remembering that, you know, it's contained. It's like the universe that you're in at that point, and you treat it like that. So that's clinical to me, you know?
Yeah, that's so beautiful. I love that story. Thank you so much for sharing that. And again, you know, just again, all my relations, north, south, east, west, you know, not getting locked into space time, that it's not linear, you know, that we're here in this whole, animated universe that we're a part of, and that we aren't even fixed anyway. And so, you know, I just think the fluidity of that is beautiful. We have about 6 minutes, 7 minutes left. We have one more question, and then we'll, you know, maybe close for this, but it's a gorgeous conversation, and I can't thank you enough. The mainstream narrative about Indigenous peoples, particularly their health, often tends to have a deficit focus, which is sort of what you were referencing earlier. What are resilience and strengths-based approaches to Indigenous healing? Which, again, we've already sort of been talking about throughout this conversation. But this idea of moving from pathology to empowerment and sort of, you know, joy, And this creative spirit, and this not just me, not this small sense of self, but as my mindfulness teacher Jack Kornfield would say, you know, not the contracted sense of self, but this larger being of being one with and a part of, not apart from.
Yeah. Well, I think you know the. I think for Indigenous people, I think you know it's really, and I can't, of course, speak for everyone, but. I think it's very important, I think, to look at, you know, to first ask this question, to flip it around, to ask therapists, you know, what do you think of your world? You know, is it working out for you? How's that working out for you? You know, how's it working out to do all this damage to the earth, right? How's that worked out when we lose our connection to you know, to this space and time and to all the natural, the things that are natural? How is it when we come to dominate, you know, all these forms of life? Does that work out, you know? And I think, you know, most wise people are going to say, no, it's not. We're at a tipping point now, you know. We're at the sixth extinction, you know, people are talking about now this human caused, you know, extinction that's happening of all these species, right? So it's the strength of Indigenous people, I think, is to understand that it's so important to be in that place, you know, with, you know, where there's order, where you have to, there's a, some kind of really respectful reciprocity with the world, right? Mm-hmm. That's really what it's about, and that's what people have fought for so long, and still are fighting so hard, you know, to stop pipelines, to stop mining, to stop pollution, to stop throwing plastic in the ocean, you know, to stop nuclear, you know, arms races and things like that. Indigenous people have been involved in that kind of thing for a long period of time, you know, resisting that kind of thing. And I think that's one of the great strengths of Indigenous people is that I think, you know, is that we have, you know, an understanding. We have that history. We have those narratives. We have that as part of our marking on Mother Earth, you know, where we've, if you go to, let's say, for example, you go to Wyoming and you go to the Bighorn Mountains, you'll see this huge medicine wheel out there that's about 10,000 years old. You know, that tribes all over Turtle Island were congregating in this place. They were seeing themselves connected to the land. And I think that's one of the things that's made us so resilient is that, you know, we just haven't given that up, right? And and that's a strength to stay connected to that. The strength is you know, in Indigenous people is understanding. And we've kind of come some mileage away from that too because of colonization. We don't live like that anymore because we're forced to live in a very different world. But, you know, at that time, at the apex of our cultures, that's really what it was that, you know, we were in ceremony so much and so often that we now know from the studies, you know, when you do these brain studies of the parietal lobe in the brain, when the parietal lobe in the brain goes quiet, that you have this transcendent experience where you actually become part of the tree or the earth or the rocks or the waters or the, you know, the eagle or whatever it is. Yeah. That people have that ability to silence that part of the brain when you're into prayer and ceremony for long, long periods of time. That's been shown on brain imaging. You know, when Tibetan monks who have had 50,000 hours of practice get into this deep meditation, that part of the, you know, and Franciscan nuns or whoever get into that place, that part of the brain goes quiet. And they experience, you know, like the Buddha did, right? You see the one drop of ocean, you know, in a drop of water and one drop in a whole ocean kind of thing. So Indigenous people around the world and all cultures around the world have been doing that for long periods of time. They begin to lose that connection. So I think that's really a strength of Indigenous people is that we've maintained the stories. Some people still maintain the practices. And as I see it now, you know, even in the social media, I see young Indigenous people trying to reclaim that again, you know, moving towards that, continue to move towards that, because I think they understand that that's going to be, at least in our minds, at least one solution to this huge climate change issue we have to deal with. I mean, racism, you know, and you know, this brutality we see on the streets and COVID-19, yeah, those are terrible, but they pale in comparison to what's coming in terms of this dramatic changes that are going to happen to the planet and may, you know, wipe out life as we know it. Not just, you know, Black Lives Matter, Indigenous Lives Matter, but it's going to wipe out, you know, we're wiping out all these species, all, you know, that are before us. And we can't even see that. And so we have to, it's important for us to come back to see what we're doing to one another.
Yeah.
Before we can begin to see what we're doing to other life outside of that.
Yeah.
If we can't do that, you know, then, you know, we're a goner as a species. So I think that's, to me, that's really one of the strengths of Indigenous people, is to have that understanding that, you know, it's still in our stories, it's still in our prayers, it's still in our markings that are in Turtle Island. You know, Judicula Rock out in Eastern Cherokee, North Carolina, has all of these pictographs in there. If you look that up, Judicula Rock, mm-hmm. out there, that shows that all these tribes on Turtle Island were all coming together at different times, again, to exchange stories, to exchange ceremony, to exchange DNA, to exchange material, to trade, you know, to try to understand the world together. It's not that it was a perfect world. It wasn't. But we can certainly see that, you know, there was some kind of convergence, moral convergence, that we understood that we were not more powerful than the earth, that we had to live in this kind of place. So I think that's the strength and the moral convergence of Indigenous people, is that we still have the respect.
Yeah. Right? So. Beautiful. Beautiful, Dr. Yellowbird. I can't say enough, like you said, a respectful reciprocity with the world. And also, you know, it's funny when you said the ocean, that's the quote from Rumi that I have on my email signature. You are not a drop in the ocean. You are the entire ocean in a drop. And so, you know, again, both of those. I thank you so much for your time. You are always a joy to engage with, and I appreciate all of what you've offered here today and continue to offer to all communities. Thank you.
I appreciate the chance to be on your program and to talk to folks. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.